Welcome to Real World Theology, episode 70. On this episode of the podcast, we are actually talking about Back to the Future. That's right, 30 years ago, or nearly 30 years ago, this movie came out and became the highest grossing movie of 1985, and the highest loved movie in all of our hearts, for those of us who were around then. It's amazing to think that it was almost 30 years ago that Marty, Biff, George, Lorraine, and Doc Brown himself were entertaining us and changing our minds about how movies needed to work, how funny they could be, how clever they could be, and how much fun they could be. So, ahead of the release of the 30th anniversary edition of Back to the Future and the impending re-release in theater for that anniversary, Real World Theology's very own Mark Wingerter, Josh Crabb, and myself review this movie, and we have all kinds of great things to say about it. We explore how the movie and many other time travel movies really point us to our own fear of the future, how it helps us understand the past, and in particular, especially with Back to Future, we talk about what it takes for a movie to stay relevant for 30 years. So we get to have a lot of fun talking about all the things we love about this movie. Most of them revolve around musical impressions and Christopher Lloyd. So here it is, episode 70, Back to the Future and Relevance. Movie theaters are modern-day pulpits. Real-world theology exists to shed a light on the narratives that are shaping our culture, and to encourage viewers to recognize that entertainment is not mindless.
All right, now make like a tree and get out of here.
Yeah, that's right.
Oh man, this movie is so quotable.
Oh yeah.
How did you guys watch it? Did you watch it before we came on?
Yeah, I just watched it a couple hours ago.
Yeah, same here.
Because I've been trying to find a time to watch it, and ultimately, like, this is the only time I had.
Right.
So
I didn't watch it, and I told Mikey it's because I've literally seen this movie more than any other movie I've ever seen.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. Well, so that's the interesting part about this movie. Because I was looking up, you know, fun facts or whatever about it, just because usually it's interesting for a movie like that's been around for 30 years. Mm-hmm. Because the whole reason that I thought it would be a good idea to do this podcast was, the 30th anniversary is coming up. It's going to be back in theaters. Almost everyone loves this movie. I mean, to different degrees. Like, mm-hmm. I find very few people who are like, didn't care for it. You know, mm-hmm. I found that the script was rejected 40 times before it was finally greenlit. And then with that 40 times of rejection, it went on to be the top grossing release of 1985.
Oh, yeah.
So it just shows, like, that, you know, maybe the guys were like, I don't know if I could handle that kind of rejection. But fortunately, they could. So it went on to be not only one of the top grossing release of 1985, but it also ended up being like a movie that is still relevant 30 years later.
Yeah.
You know, people still want to see it. Still people, I think it is not quite to the, like the Star Wars, like cultural penetration, but it's something people want to watch with their kids.
Yeah.
You know, it's still got that. I also looked up that it's ranked at number 9 on IGN's top 25 movie franchises of all time. Mm-hmm. I feel like it probably makes most top 100 lists of mm-hmm. all-time movies mm-hmm. to varying degrees, depending on the list and thing, especially if you narrow it down to, like, sci-fi and stuff like this. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's obviously been around forever. It has a great soundtrack.
That it does.
You know, because Huey Lewis is awesome. And I also read that Huey Lewis was in the movie. I didn't know that.
Yeah. He's the guy that says that Marty is too loud.
When he's playing like his version of Power of Love.
Yeah, Power of Love.
Which is really funny.
Yeah.
That's another thing that is so great about this movie is that it works on so many levels. There's so many little, like, perfect things. Are we recording, by the way, right now?
Mm-hmm. And now I have to take that out.
Oh. Wait, it's just part of the job, you know, get them a little behind the scenes kind of thing.
But you're a professional. You know we're always recording.
I mean, it just seems kind of sudden. We usually have like a 45-minute conversation before the.
Well, it's an old movie. You know, we're all pros. We're all pros. 45-minute conversation.
So it works on so many levels. Like it's very like. Into its detail. I don't know if that's just Zemeckis' style, you know, if that's just kind of how he works. I mean, it's a Spielberg-produced movie, but there's so many little things that are throwback to things in the movie that are throwback to, you know, things in the culture at the time. I mean, like, when Marty's like, I'll have a tab, you know, which is a cola, and then in the 50s he's like... Yeah. You gotta order something for me to give you a tab, son. You know?
Yeah, I don't think the movie really, after watching it this time, that I really got into it until he went back in time to 1955. Like before that, it's kind of like, it's got a lot of the same, you know, tropes of like any John Hughes movie from the 80s.
Mm-hmm.
Then once he goes back, it seems like the dialogue and just all the little clever here's and there's everywhere, mm-hmm. you know, it's just kind of, it really goes to a different level as a movie when it goes back in time. And then it's, you know, everybody's brilliant in this movie. I mean, it's just, you know, from Michael J. Fox to Christopher Lloyd to, you know, to even like Crispin Glover as the big giant nerd and, you know, Biff is just hilarious.
Yeah.
Well, so you know, I'm watching it again today, in preparation for this, and I noticed that there's so much like exposition before he goes back to 1955.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I'm just like, this is what movies do that I hate. But once he, I think you're kind of onto something, because once he gets back to 1955, mm-hmm. it pays all the exposition off.
Yeah.
Like, there's, like, none of the exposition is wasted.
Yeah.
It's all, like, line for line or scene for scene, mm-hmm. Kind of helping him connect, you know, his present or his past to his present.
Right.
And that, while being campy, I'm like, heck, for an 80s movie, I think that's actually pretty good. And I think it still works today. But
well, that's why it works on the time travel level, like, so well, I think, is because it pays so much attention to the details that it already set up in mm-hmm. that exposition.
Yeah.
And it makes you feel like you are connected to the past and the present. You know, you're connected to the present, well, whenever you're watching this in 1985.
1985, yeah.
But, you know, and even now, I mean, I guess why it's got that staying power with our culture is that, you know, we still feel connected to Marty and his family and all that stuff and all the little details that Marty would notice in his world because they're his world. We also notice in the past and how it's like, you know, McFly, you know, that like it's that we're connected to that, you know, across time
and space.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, so it's like a bedrock of, you know, not just nerd culture, but pop culture in general.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. You know, Robert Zemeckis did this film, and he's got a very impressive belt of movies. You know, Romancing the Stone, Forrest Gump, Contact, Castaway. I'm guessing The Walk is probably going to be probably pretty great.
Mind-blowing, yeah.
Yeah, that I will probably not be able to see from Fear of Heights and Vertigo and stuff like that. I don't want to throw up in a theater. But I'm sure that, like, from a filmmaking standpoint, it'll probably do something that we either haven't seen before or rarely see. You know, because that's, I think, what he ends up doing lots of times with lots of these films. Back to the Future did it. I mean, Forrest Gump was something that we just don't see.
Mm-hmm.
Someone written into history. And, yeah. I mean, so many kind of corny ways it works. And Castaway was different. Contact was different.
Yeah, Zemeckis is a patient director.
Mm-hmm.
He really takes the time. He's not afraid to take the time to build the story. I mean, he directed Castaway. I mean, Castaway is, you know, that's all time and patience. I mean, it takes incredible nerve to direct a movie like that. you know, and even like, you know, Flight is, I mean, his movies can come off as long, but there's a lot of patience there. There's a lot of time that he takes, mm-hmm. you know, and like Forrest Gump is one of those where it's just like, you have to, I mean, this is a guy's life that you're telling, you have to take the time to do this. So that really worked for this movie too. And I mean, I don't know, I can't really compare his early career to his current mm-hmm. career. I mean, I know his big movies like this one, but you know, he really takes the time, and I think that helped, because this movie, you know, is about time.
Well, and I was
so come on. Yeah.
I mean, you know, if we could, that joke was so bad, I'd like to go
bad puns.
Back in time.
Yeah.
But
good recovery.
Yeah, there you go. So, like I said, of course, we're doing this for a myriad of reasons. Mm-hmm. Like I said, it's going to be back in the theater for probably like a week or so when the 30th anniversary mm-hmm. edition comes out. It's still culturally relevant.
Right.
It has made, a profound impact on all of us. I mean, it's something that we would, like, whenever it's on TV, I'm like, I'm going to probably end up watching this from, you know, whatever point in the movie it is.
Oh, yeah.
So, like I said,
and it's always on TV.
And it's either
at
one,
any
two,
one
or three.
Time you can find, if you have enough channels,
yeah.
you can find Back to the Future.
On channel. So, and like I said, I think we've danced around this and maybe even answered it to a certain degree, but I want to plainly state some of our opinions on why this movie is still a thing 30 years later. Why are they making Legos out of it? Like in the past year, mm-hmm. you know? Or year or two. I can't remember when the actual set came out, the DeLorean set. Like, it's still something that people are making and buying. So there's got to be something about it. And I love the fact that, like I said, you're already hitting on the thing that it's culturally relevant. It connects us to our past, things like that. But why would you specifically say, if someone asked you, like, why should I see this film? I've never seen it. Josh?
I think that a reason to see it, well, I mean, first of all, like you said, it is kind of one of the bedrock movies of our culture. And I mean, it's instantly probably one of the more entertaining sci-fi comedy movies that you'll ever see. But yeah, it has an enduring appeal because it's just it's not stuck in a moment. It's a movie that kind of goes, it's both future looking and past looking in a good way, you know, to bend with time. But I really think that it's just an important cultural artifact that continues to be relevant, even though it's approaching the point where it's 30 years and technically part two is traveling to now, which is just silly, but maybe that makes the first part even better, is that it doesn't bother trying to do any of that stuff. There's no speculation point here. Like, it's already going to history that's already happened. And mm-hmm. so, you know, it's able to endure because of how well it nailed those, you know, being in 85 and then being in 55 so well. And, you know, I mean, it's such a great movie. Like, from top down, just the story's fun. It's compact. Like, the movie's almost 2 hours long, but it doesn't feel like it. There's so much packed into this movie in under 2 hours. And, yeah. You know, I think that this movie, like I already said, continues to endure, and every aspect of the movie is just extremely well done. Mm-hmm. It's just a well done movie.
Yeah. So I think one of the things that I noticed this time, and something we've already hit on, is that, without saying it specifically, is that it really rewards repeat viewings.
Oh, yeah.
Because there's so many things that I miss going through it the first time. It's not just a silly, like, 80s comedy. Mm-hmm. It's not just a...
Which is amazing, because it could have been.
It could have been, like, a wacky 80s comedy.
Yeah.
But, like, it seemed smarter than it should have been at times. Like I said, there's... I think, Mark, you said it, you know, it hits on so many tropes.
Yeah.
That we would normally be like, whatever.
right.
But it uses those tropes, like I was mentioning before, and really pays them all off. And so... I love the fact that almost every time I watch this movie, I noticed something different. I mean, for all the times that I've seen this movie randomly on TV, I never noticed that the name of the mall changes from Twin Pines to Lone Pine. Never noticed.
Yeah.
I mean, because it's totally not something that someone says. You know.
Oh, yeah.
He's just Marty's coming back from the future or from back from the past, and it's just like we're not even focused on it. He just walks by the sign. Signs changed.
Yep.
Never noticed.
And that's again that patience just to have that just a visual joke that maybe you catch it, maybe you don't.
Mm-hmm.
Which you probably should spell out for people listening if they haven't caught it. It's like, you know, at the beginning of the movie, the mall is called Twin Pines Mall.
Mm-hmm.
And then as he travels back to the future, or back to the past.
Back to the future.
It's easy to do because it's so part of our culture. But as he's, the first time he goes back and he's at Twin Pines Mall location, right? But he's, you know, has zoomed back into 1955 and that was a tree farm and the guy had, or wasn't it just a barn?
You're into the barn.
Anyway, he runs over one of two pines, and the guy's like, "My pines!" And then at the end of the movie, that joke pays off because it's the Lone Pine Mall.
Yeah.
It's so great.
So great. Is it great, though?
Yeah, it is great, man.
All right, so Mark, why do you, someone comes up to you and says, "Why should I watch this movie? I've never seen this movie." You know, I was born in, 1995. Yeah. I never saw this movie. Didn't see a reason to see it.
Well,
it's an old movie. It's an old movie. You know?
Well, young whippersnapper, I would say.
I would seem to say.
I think the first time I saw the movie, I was probably 8 or 9.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway.
Well, that's actually something I'd be interested in. When was the first time you saw it?
Yes, but I think I was about 8 or 9.
Do you remember like where? Or?
Yeah, I was at my aunt's house. We were up in Virginia visiting family. And I was a kid and I needed something to do. And so it was rainy. And so we went, you know, rented some movies, which I used to love to do as a kid. Rent movie, you know, that's a passing gone.
What's a rent movie? Oh, you mean like on iTunes?
Yeah. So we went to the video store. And my mom was like, "Oh, you have a
video store?
I think you're ready for Back to the Future. I think you haven't seen Back to the Future yet." So we got all three of them, and I watched all three of them. And I was like blown away. So I think it is. I think you should watch it, because it's culturally relevant, because this is the only true time travel movie. Like, really, there's movies that travel in time, there's movies that, like, you know, the H.G. Wells story, you know, the Time Machine.
Mm-hmm.
There are movies made out of that have been pretty crappy. This is the only, I think people love time travel, the idea of time travel, because we want to believe that it exists, and we want to believe it exists because we want to go and, you know, visit and play in the past or in the future or in a time, you know, somewhere else beside. We want to have, you know, I think on a philosophical level, we want to be able to control time.
Mm-hmm.
But this is the only movie that really kind of like takes the time to play in the past. And as with the sequels, because I don't think you can talk about this movie anymore without talking about the sequels, they really take the time to play in the times that they are in. Even though, you know, Marty is trying to get the heck out of 1955 and get back home, they take all these jokes and all these fun, like, they're being very playful and fantastical with all of these, you know, with this concept that maybe if you could travel in time, what would you do? And I think we're all drawn to that for many reasons. This is the only movie that really takes the time to say, what if you went back in 1955? I mean, yes, we need to have a story around it. There's a story, and it's a great story. Which is another reason why, I mean, you're with Marty. He's the fish out of water, kind of going through his own hero's journey. And you know, we're drawn to that, too. But this is the only really good time travel movie.
So, I know there's a lot
of... Can you name another
time travel? Well, I can say, I know lots of other time travel movies, but I would say most of them came after and then use the concept that we see in Back to the Future to map how they did their movies. Like, lots of the time travel jokes we get now,
mm-hmm.
or funny scenarios we get, usually center around referencing Back to the Future in some way.
Mm-hmm.
'Cause you have to also remember that right before, or the year before Back to the Future came out, something we mentioned a couple podcasts ago is that Terminator, the original, came out in 1984.
Yeah.
So apparently audiences in the 80s were really, really fascinated
with time travel. Yeah.
With, you know, going back and the future, making a better future, seeing what the future is going to be like.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, heck, even in this one, there's this concept that, well, I mean, in Terminator, there was an idea that there was going to be a nuclear holocaust. Like, the 80s nuclear holocaust was, like, the presumed future in every movie, yeah. You know? Because even Doc Brown says, like, why are we need the radiation soup? Oh, of course, because of all the nuclear war, nuclear missiles or whatever. Of course!
Of course.
Like, what else would it be? Like, there's this concern with the future, and then being able to, like, affect the future. And I think there's a lot of fear of the unknown, which I think everyone has.
Right.
And I think one of the things that I love about Back to the Future is watching it this time, especially knowing that I was going to be kind of like diving into like how has it been around for 30 years. I think it still represents something that we see in tons of films today. We see in like almost all the dystopian stuff that we see today is, you know, a fear of the future. And mm-hmm. So the irony is Back to the Future is really about going back to the past and hopefully changing the present, mm-hmm. but it still marks a fear of the future, like knowing like what we proving that what happens at a certain time is going to eventually affect our future time, mm-hmm. and so like I said, they do it in a very almost subversive way by going back to the past and showing how even little things in 1955 can affect what is going to happen in 1985. Yeah. It's kind of a reminder that hey, so the things in 1985. Are going to affect the things that happen in 2015, mm-hmm. and then we get Back to the Future 2, mm-hmm. Which basically plays that out.
Yeah,
and all the Terminator movies, this is what they do. I remember watching like Peabody and Sherman, which was not a very good movie in my personal opinion, mm-hmm. but it plays with this. Hey, we went back, we did this thing. Oh, we messed everything up. Now we got to fix it.
Mm-hmm.
So it happens a lot. There's that fear. What are we going to do? Snowpiercer.
Oh,
gosh. Well, every dystopian movie.
There's so many time travel oriented stories out there. Look at the Terminators. I mean, the Terminator, I was looking at, top 25 best of time travel movie lists, and Terminator 2 is way up at the top, usually the second to Back to the Future. But it's not a time travel movie. You know, it's a movie that has time travel in it. It's not the impetus. It's not the whole, idea mm-hmm. surrounding the film, you know. And I think the reason why this movie continues to be so culturally relevant is that it really plays out a version of people's imagination could be if they were to time travel, and what they think about, like, oh, if you were going to go back in time or forward in time, what would you do? And
so you're saying this is more culturally relevant than Hot Tub Time Machine?
Absolutely.
Which is basically Back to the Future?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
I mean, isn't it? So that's one of the funny things to me. So reading like that, even though it was never their first choice, there was a long shot that John Cusack could have played Marty McFly.
Yeah, yeah.
So basically, John Cusack gets a chance to play Marty McFly in Hot Tub Time Machine.
Yeah.
Which I don't necessarily recommend to all audiences.
No, yeah.
But that goes back to the point of most time travel movies since Back to the Future. If they spend any time not just using time travel as like a funny device, mm-hmm. they actually spend time in the past or in the future, it usually pulls a lot from this movie.
Right.
And I would say that's one of its enduring qualities.
Yeah, and I don't think there's any, you know, it's hard to, when you're basing a story around time travel, you know, you don't really have a whole lot of, basing it around time travel, you don't have a whole lot of options, I guess. It kind of tells itself. The only thing you can do is affect the future, you know, is a big, mm-hmm. big thing. So, you know, I think this movie remains in our cultural times because it is so well done. You know, mm-hmm. it just took that idea, took a time travel movie, and did it so well.
So, Fizz, you had said that, like, Peabody and Sherman was a movie that actually is using, you know, time travel not just as a device in the movie like Terminator, but I think maybe another movie, it's not necessarily something that is influenced by Back to the Future because it only came out a year afterwards, but When I think of like time travel movies that were at least somewhat okay, like Star Trek IV: The Voyage Home is pretty great.
Oh yeah,
and that one uses time, and time travel just isn't a device. Like, it's kind of the main plot of the movie is dealing with going back in time to, you know, capture some whales.
Right.
And so I don't know. But again, you know, Terminator's not really a time travel movie, so I don't necessarily agree that it's going to be number two on a list of time travel movies. But of course, it's like, what do you, you rate it based on like percentage of usage of time travel?
Yeah. Who's making these rules?
So, you know, I mean, there hasn't been a lot of really great movies about time travel. If you want to think of something a little bit shorter, like the episode of The Simpsons where they go back in time, and then there's all those small changes that Homer makes that, like, you know, leads towards at the end of the episode when it's like there's no donuts in his future, but then he like runs out and then the donuts start raining from the sky.
Oh, now see,
it's the butterfly effect.
Yeah.
But see, there's the thing. I mean, if you want to start talking about TV shows, well, then we got to talk Doctor Who. So, you know, no. I mean, there's been tons of great Doctor Who episodes and time travel, you know, TV as well. Gosh, I mean, that's a rabbit hole. But I mean, as far as like, you know, movie franchises, which are, you know, with the movie franchise, the studio is pouring more money in because they're getting more money, you know, than they are from a TV show or something like that.
Sure.
Usually, I mean, I guess, you know, depends on the franchise, but, mm-hmm. you know, in general. so, I mean, you know, this sets itself up as, like, the quintessential, I mean, it is, it's the quintessential time travel franchise.
Mm. Well, and I think it captures sort of, like, it really captures the spirit of, like, what the human imagination is surrounding time travel.
Yeah.
And sort of how we view ourselves, both past, present, and future. We kind of have this, you know, this fatalistic mindset towards time travel. Like, if you go back in time, you don't just go there. It's not like going to a museum or something like that. Like, you don't just go back to observe or whatever. You know, it's not like Scrooge going back in time, you know, right. and just sort of observing in an invisible state. But, like, mm-hmm. there's actual consequences because you're a real physical being. So if you could travel back in time and do something different, like, there are consequences for even some of the smallest actions that you make.
Right.
So, gosh. Yeah.
Well, so, yeah, what it does, like I said, it reminds me of the fact that it makes me think more about the future than the past, ironically. A movie about going back to the past reminds me of the future more than the past. Because it really makes me want to get every single thing I can, like in a not direct but kind of subconscious encouragement way, like, get as much out of every scenario you're a part of, like every interaction, you know, be present, kind of take a stand, be bold, because, mm-hmm. I mean, like, these things are going to shape who you are, how people see you, you know, these outcomes. Now, I would say that I don't want to call it silliness necessarily, but, like, the convenience of Back to the Future is it can say this event and this event mm-hmm. and this event completely changed everything.
Yeah.
And I think there are probably some defining life events like that, but I think on the whole, right. it would take a lot of things to change, and
right.
it encourages me to try to be a better person
right.
over a long period of time than try to be a good person to one person one time.
Right. Yeah, like what you're saying, like George McFly, you know, getting up the courage to, you know, punch Biff,
yeah.
you know, in the climax of the movie, changes his, you know, complete attitude towards others and how he views himself mm-hmm. as a, you know, weakling versus a, you know, a stronger character, I guess.
Hey, George, I heard you punched out Biff.
Yeah.
You should run for class president. Like, does that happen?
I don't know.
Funny. There's so many times in that movie where it has those devices, but it's funny because it's such a great movie, you don't care. But, like, even when the DeLorean crashes into the barn and Marty's there, and then there's that device, the device of just kind of like these casual moments just like that seem to happen all the time where it's like, you know, Fizz, you just said, like, hey, why don't you run for class president? It's like when the family, the, I think it's the Peabody family, and actually the kid's name is Sherman, so there's a throwback for you.
So, yeah.
But, that's right. But, you know, they all go out. The Peabody family goes out to the barn, and he's like, what is that thing? And then the kid's like, it's a, he's got a comic book with him that he brought out to the barn. And he's like, yeah. Oh, look, well, it's this guy from, it's the aliens from Pluto. And a spaceman from Pluto or whatever. And it's just, it's so funny because it's like, come on, he wouldn't bring a comic book outside. But there's so many moments in the movie where it's, or like even when he first gets into Hill Valley in like the middle of the town. Like, he's walking around, he walks right by a trash can, and a guy throws a newspaper into the garbage face up, like, right as he's right there. It's just so... It's funny how there's those little things to keep the plot moving and to help him make those small little beats or those small little realizations or whatever, but it's just, you don't care because the movie is so good, it doesn't even matter.
Yeah.
Okay, so that actually reminds me of something that also struck me when I watched this film. Mm-hmm. It's that there are... We talked about the tropes. There are tropes in this film that I feel if I watched a movie today and saw it, I would not give it this much leeway. And I think that's because most of the time when they see these like conveniences or expositions or, you know, overemphasis on this one event to kind of set up something, it's almost always in a film where the film's taking itself too seriously. So when it turns around and does this, like, it can't just have fun with itself.
Yeah.
So like, this one's like, look what we're doing. Look, we're telling you we're doing it. Yeah. We all know we're doing it. Let's just have some fun. Yeah. And I'm like, all right.
It's that playfulness I'm talking about.
And I just, I think that's when we finally see playful movies today that, it's actually refreshing.
Yeah.
I mean, it's hard to do it right because...
It's hard to do it right, and they don't often get the license to do it.
I mean,
like,
true.
The producers are like, well, this needs to be, you know, they're just kind of...
Because I think when most people think playful today, I think the closest thing we get are, like, raunchy comedies or, like...
Well, I think the first Avengers movie is a good example. I mean, Joss Whedon lets those characters, you know, just play and, like, joke with each other and have all those in-jokes and, you know, and, like, make fun of the fact that they're comic book characters.
They're larger than life.
Yeah.
So, like I said, I think it's more rare than not. And
of course, Joss does it better than anybody.
Boom. Got on the throne.
But, I mean, he pretty
take
much...
Take that, Robert Zemeckis.
Pretty much all of his work is playful like that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So... It reminded, like, what else, I was thinking, what else does this film do, I guess, made in the 80s when more films were playful like this? You know, that's why you can kind of tell when something's an 80s movie.
Yeah.
Because it typically doesn't take itself too seriously. Or when it's being dramatic, it's almost, like, so over-dramatic. You're like, gosh, that's what it was like when I was a teenager. You know, like, it is... They're making fun of their own premise, you know, and it's fun and stuff like that. And I was struck by the fact that we almost never have this today, or at least done in a way that I think works well. And that's bad guys are bad, and like the hero is just trying to do something good.
Mm-hmm.
Like Biff in this movie is just the bad guy.
Yeah.
Like we're not concerned about we don't see like shots of Biff at home getting like yelled at by his dad, and tormented, and he's just a bully.
He's the quintessential bully.
Yeah, we're okay with him just being like a stereotype,
right?
Because it lets us have fun with the premise.
Right.
We don't have to sit and have like this existential crisis of like, what's good and bad, and is he? Everyone's really bad. Mm-hmm. Like he's just a bully.
Yeah.
And we want to see him get covered in crap.
Right.
You know, like that's what we want. We can say this is just, that's unjust, and it works and we like it.
Yeah, and I'm not sure how we've evolved to in our movie choices and our story choices as far as bad guys go, because we definitely, you know, we are the era of the anti-hero. You know, we've got the Walter Whites and the Dexters of the world. You know, that are our main characters, and you know, we don't really get a lot of you know, Technicolor, this is good, this is bad movies anymore necessarily. I mean, you have, especially in a franchise, like you have a franchise of like, you know, of course this wasn't set out to be a franchise, but you know, in our franchises now, like the Marvel movies, I mean, when you get a bad guy that's just a bad guy and is just trying to destroy the universe or something.
For reasons.
For reasons. I mean, you know, He's either not done very well, or people don't like it if he's just only bad. Mm-hmm. What are the bad guys that people like in the Marvel movies? Loki. They love Loki.
That's it.
Yeah, and Loki was like, you know, what's the line about, Thor's trying to defend Loki? Well, he's my brother, and, you know, he's an Asgardian. It's just like, he killed all these people. He's like, well, he's adopted. And people love Loki because of that, because, you know, he has done all these, you know, terrible things, but he's still kind of the, you know, we're going to get in there with Loki and, you know, kind of play out our badness. You don't really get that in this movie. You don't get that option to play with your badness.
Yeah, so this is what's interesting about it to me. And these are the dots that I would connect. And this is one of those conversations that I would love to have that goes on for a long time, because it starts a boulder, or, well, it starts a pebble down a hill that I think if you follow it down that hill, by the time it gets to the bottom, it is a boulder. Mm-hmm. And that is, it shows the ever-waning agreement upon common morality in a society. Because even in the 80s, there was, I think, an idea, even though it was changing, mm-hmm. you got more movies that had a bad guy who was just bad. Mm-hmm. You knew he was bad because he did X, Y, and Z. Or heck, lots of times he just did X. You didn't even need him to do Y and Z. Mm-hmm. You just knew he was bad. We could all agree he was bad. And we never had to question that. There was never a reason to question bad guys, because you knew there were bad people, because we all had more of a common morality. And it came, you know, a lot of it came, especially, was very strong in the 50s. Mm-hmm. But now we live in a more postmodern age. A postmodern age that's like, you know, truth is relative, mm-hmm. or there is no truth. Mm-hmm. The only truth is your personal truth, or mm-hmm. relative truth, or, you know, it's different for everybody, or what works for you, right. works for you, not mm-hmm. for me. And so whenever we tell someone a story and we say, Biff is the bad guy, they're like, is Biff really a bad guy? I mean, maybe he's misunderstood.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like, what do we know about his home life? Mm-hmm. What do we know about, like, is he adopted?
Yeah.
Like, does he have baggage from something like that?
We dissect our bad guys.
Was he picked on when he was in elementary school? Mm-hmm. And so he created sociological and psychological defense mechanisms, so he became a bully, so he could be the biggest bully. Does he have a learning disorder? And he, sure. Et cetera, et cetera. I could do this all day, because this is what we do with almost every bad guy right now.
Yeah.
And which, I mean,
we write whole shows about bad guys now.
Right.
Exactly. And I think someone wrote a pretty good breakdown of the antihero for Real World Theology.
That guy's a smart guy. Yeah, smart
talking,
idea.
Talking about Walter White from Breaking Bad, and talking about Dexter from Dexter.
That was me.
That was smart. You know, so we do have a cultural obsession that I think is not necessarily waning, but it's not like the rule anymore. Because I would say for about 5 years, if you didn't have an anti-hero, mm-hmm. people just didn't even care. They're like, yeah. I don't agree with your definition of bad or even good. You know, our heroes had to be flawed, like right. vastly flawed, and our bad guys had to be kind of good or confusedly bad.
Right.
And I think that's changing, and I'm hoping it was because we saw movies like Captain America, where mm-hmm. we were like, wait a minute, I miss a dude being good.
Yeah.
And being good at being good.
Yeah.
And not being good in like a hokey way.
Yeah, and I mean, look at that movie. You had Red Skull.
Yeah.
All bad.
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 Why was he bad? Because he's a bad guy.
Yeah, he's a bad guy. You know, we didn't dissect him. Of course, you know, he had that kind of Nazi, you know, affiliation.
Yeah.
Which is how we, basically now, now, if you have a bad guy who's just bad, you generally throw it back to like, well, he's a Nazi.
Well,
he's really bad then.
He must be a Nazi.
I mean, he is. I mean, that's a good way to do it.
It's 2007.
It's almost like we're afraid to, but yeah, I mean, it's almost like we're afraid to even to go anywhere much further outside of the mm-hmm. fact that somebody's a Nazi, is a bad guy. You know, it's almost like we're afraid to call people bad guys anymore.
Well, it has to
and maybe that's a good thing, and maybe it's not. I think this movie simplifies it. And so you get to kind of, you know, it's almost like you get to relax, because you know who's the bad guy. You know where the lines are drawn. You know who you're rooting for. You know who you're rooting against. You know, there's nobody in history that is a commonsensical person that has rooted for Biff. You know, like, I mean, you don't root for Biff. Biff is a bad guy. because Biff's a jerk. And, you know, Biff needs to get his comeuppance. And, and that's what this movie sets up. And so, you know, and the fact that it's giving you that chance to do what we don't get to do in life. And that's go back in time and redo things. Because, you know, like you mentioned it before about choices, about, you know, affecting things. And the only thing we can do is affect the future. Even if we go back in time, we can't affect the past. That's not something you could physically do, because it's, by nature, we are going, you know, depending on how you view time, we are going forward in time. So you can only affect the future. Whatever you do is going to affect the next thing down the road. So it really does, you know, time travel movies really set up that, you know, kind of sense of like, if I can just go back and redo things, maybe I can change the past. No, you're still affecting the future. So take a look at your present and understand that. You know, we get to, you know, what sci-fi does is gives, you know, Technicolor big accented examples of real life themes and struggles. And that's one of those things, is to look at time and think, man, if I could just go back, well, what about now? You know, you can't go back. You cannot change the past, even if you have a time machine. Mm-hmm. You know, change the future. You can change the future. No matter what you do, your actions are going to affect what's next.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I would say that, I mean, we're told that the secular version is those who don't know their history are doomed to repeat it.
Mm-hmm.
I would say that the more biblical version is there's nothing new under the sun.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so like things we've seen, we're going to see again. And sometimes it helps to look back, to learn from the past, but to long and spend all your time in the past.
Mm-hmm.
There's got to be something in Ecclesiastes about this, right? You know, like, you know, like there's this piece about moving forward and understanding that you're a continual work. So you're making mistakes, but you're always, you're heading in this direction. So you're remembering the past with your eyes forward,
mm-hmm.
is how I've heard it said before.
Yeah.
So
there's also this sense of cool to this movie, you know, to this whole time travel scenario. Like, it is dealing with these themes that we're talking about, but kind of examining this movie and you know, 30 years later, it's like when Tony Stark is first creating the first Iron Man suit. You know, the one in his, after he escapes, the actual Iron Man suit. And he's like, you know, throw a little Hot Rod Red in there. You know, this movie takes time travel and just throws a little Hot Rod Red
on it. Makes it look cool.
You know, it's got a DeLorean and the doors open up. I mean, it just has this sense of like, if you were going to go back in time, this is the way you want to do it. In style, a little bit. A little kind of a raggedy style, but, it, you know, it's something that's endearing, too. So, I don't know. It hits on all these levels.
That's, well, Doc Brown says that. If you're going to travel back in time, you might as well travel in style. That's right, a DeLorean. Right.
But what could be more stylish forever?
I'm just going to put a cap on the previous conversation about anti-heroes by saying that because Zemeckis has basically survived every attempt to try and redo anything else with his Back to the Future series since it concluded. Mm-hmm. I'm just glad that we're not getting what inevitably be like the TV show where it goes back to like Biff's origins to being the bad guy. You know, it's like a three season like Breaking Bad style Biff. Like, how does Biff get to being the bully?
Yeah, better call Biff.
Or something like that. Oh my gosh.
It was like Biff's, Biff Tannen Auto Repair or whatever he is in the movie. I forget that.
So, in regards to those, like Biff the bad guy, I would almost posit though that it's almost impossible to make him a sympathetic bad guy in the movie because he kind of comes off, and I'm going to backtrack a little, create some groundwork before getting to what I'm feeling about this. But I almost feel like at times I felt like this movie had like almost a comic book feel in the way that the actors react to certain things. Like, I didn't think it was any more obvious than when Marty trips Biff before he's able to confront George McFly, Marty's dad. He trips him, and then Biff gets up, and then he like slowly rises over Marty, but then like you see sort of Michael J. Fox like react to it, but then almost like look over his shoulder at the camera, like, this guy's big, isn't he? And there's like this fun comic booky feel to the movie. And Biff, and I would say even like Mr. Strickland, are kind of like these two bad guys that are almost like serialized bad guys, that they show up and they fail, and then they're like, "Ooh, I'll get you next time," kind of, yeah. You know.
Well,
and
I mean,
so they don't really have that kind of anti-hero arc they have. Like, they're right. Not the reason that the movie's progressing. Like, they're not doing a ton to prevent this, you know, Marty from getting to where he's needing to go. He just needs to get away from the flying fists of Biff.
Yeah, well, I mean, just look at Doc. I mean, Doc is, you know, when you think of a mad scientist, you think of the white hair and, you know, kind of the Albert Einstein look. And, I mean, even his dog is named Einstein. Like, this is a very comic booky, colorful palette movie, and that's part of the charm.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think
21 gigawatts.
We could make a whole podcast of just quoting the lines. when this baby gets up to 88 miles per hour, I won't finish that quote. But yeah, I mean, this, you know, and I think a lot of the a lot of these choices, like to colorful palette and these kind of accentuated versions of things, were very, very intentional. You know, I feel like today, if you saw something like this, it would almost be incidental, and we might be kind of poking fun at it. You know, oh, of course he's a mad scientist, of course he's a bully, that kind of thing. But these are very deliberate to kind of set this in a, you know, I think, because when we look back at this, and the reason why I think this movie doesn't need to be redone, you know, of course I don't think a lot of movies should be redone that are, and I still enjoy them, but, you know, and I'm glad that Robert Zemeckis was like, I mean, literally, over my dead body. Mm-hmm, I will be dead before this movie will. And he still got a good 25 years to go. So, you know, I think, you know, when you look back and you say, well, this movie is an 80s movie, but yes, but he is from the 80s. So, and I think this movie stands up because it is very, I think they purposefully very set this in the 80s. Mm-hmm. Like, made it very 80s, because he goes back into 1955. He doesn't ask for, just give me a Pepsi. He asks for a Pepsi Free, which is a very 80s, you know, it was like a very, very current thing. He asks for a Tab. You know, like, these are very, very specifically current things that were going on at the time, and I think that they specifically pulled those out so that this would stand up for, it wouldn't date the movie, basically. It wouldn't look like an 80s movie, because that was what it was. It would look like it's set in the 80s. I think they did that very deliberately, and I think that that's why it holds up until now, 30 years later, because, like, I never drank a Pepsi. I can't remember drinking a Pepsi Free. It's certainly not on the shelves now, but it was very 80s, and he's from the 80s, and that sets him there, no matter where he is. So in the look, the soundtrack, everything is very particularly 80s. I mean, they chose a DeLorean, you know? There's nothing more current, retro, kind of perfect thing to say this is the 80s than a DeLorean, you know?
Yeah, which is so crazy, because it's just, it seems they made so many choices of things that are just so obsolete now. You know, it's not like, you know, I don't think this car was around in 85, but it'd be like if they chose like a Toyota Corolla or something, you know, like it's the most boring, long-standing car, you know, but it's the DeLorean, which has its own mythology almost on its own.
Yeah. And Zemeckis was, you know, really specific about coming out saying, I never wanted to go to the future, because when you go to the future, and he did, of course, in the second movie, but like he didn't want to do that because he said, you're always wrong.
Yeah.
Always.
Except if the Cubs win the World Series this year.
Which would be great. I'm not a big baseball fan.
If they win the World Series, like, our culture is going to collectively, like, melt itself.
Wouldn't that be funny?
I mean,
wish I could go back, put some money on the Cubbies, you know? What did you say?
It's Because it's not far-fetched that it can happen.
I know, it's not that far-fetched. Isn't that funny?
Which is really weird, because it's like the first time it's not been far-fetched in a long time.
I mean, and look at, you know, just take a step back and look at the cultural relevance of this movie, especially now. Of course, it's all coming back because of we're actually in the future of the second movie. But, like, would there be companies trying so hard to get a hoverboard out now, this year, if it weren't for this movie? No. Right? We don't need hoverboards. It's been in the first prototypes that are out there now, they actually hover. We do have hoverboards now. But, you know, would they be trying so hard to get it out for 2015 if it wasn't for this movie? No. You know, and that's, I mean, look at the impact of this film and really, you know, the trilogy as a whole. It's huge. And, you know, I think that there's so many reasons why, you know.
Well, with that said,
this is the whole conversation.
Which is the whole conversation. Like, why it goes back to the very first question. Why?
Yeah.
Why is it still around? Like, what cultural impact does it have? And I would say that there was this really great article that Josh actually brought to our attention from the Dissolve. I mean, and the Dissolve has tons of great articles, so that's not really narrowing it down. But it was talking about how Back to the Future can be almost a warning, and probably not, well, maybe a little bit to us. I hate always like having to get tangents, but especially Mark and I are probably getting around the age when we start saying things weren't as good as when, like, we were, you know, like the cartoons that kids watch nowadays, I'm like, can't hold a candle to the stuff I watched. Mm-hmm. Like, the music when I was, like, a teenager is way better than, like, the music people are listening to now. And what this thing does is basically, like,
speak for yourself. I'm not really there yet.
You know, I say we're getting to the age where people start doing that a lot more. So it's probably people who may not even listen to this show or might not even take the time to think about this. But, the you know, people are like, oh, I get this a lot in culture, you know. What happened to us? We were so much better, you know, greatest generation. People were always willing to do these things. It's like the feeling I get when I watch, like, The Sandlot, you know? Like, what happened to the days, you know, like I said, you hear older people say this, what happened to the days when I could, we let our kids go out in the morning and then they just come back by dinner time, you know, and they play baseball and they meet friends and they scrape their knees and they'd get in trouble, but not too much trouble, you know? Mm-hmm. And we weren't worried about people stealing them or killing them or, you know, things like that. And they could make friends. They would go outside and things were so much better than, you know, when, like, affirmative fist.
Yeah.
Things like that. And I really like in this article, it kind of warns us, or something that Back to the Future kind of lets us know is, and I'll quote it. It says, "It's dangerous to try to get back to some past, and that any imagined golden age is never quite as golden as it's remembered to be." Mm-hmm. The 50s of the film is a place of coonskin caps and neat suburban lawns, but also racial prejudice, sexual menace, and the sort of general paranoia that makes a farmer take a shotgun to a visitor from another world. And I would hope that, because he goes on to talk about, or the article goes on to talk about how being able to look back at our past is helpful because it allows us to humanize people who are just like an idea. And I would hope that something that we could take away from this film is something along those lines. One of the reasons that I really, really wanted to talk about this film is when I was kind of poking around, I saw that Bob Gale, the guy who wrote the film with Robert Zemeckis, you know, kind of, he said the inspiration for the film largely stemmed from discovering his father's high school yearbook and wondering whether he would have been friends with his father as a teenager. He said that if he had the chance to go back in time, he would really go back and just see if they would have been friends. I just love the idea of wanting to go back, not to change things, which I think we've kind of established would be very hard because we don't get to go back, like, in A Christmas Carol, typically, mm-hmm. as like a spirit who just observes. Mm-hmm. If we went back, we would likely change everything mm-hmm. just by meeting somebody mm-hmm. under the rules of Back to the Future time travel. Mm-hmm. But it would really be really great, not just to hear a story from somebody, but to actually live the story. Mm-hmm. That's just really cool to me. And I feel like, I hope it's cool to everybody else.
Yeah.
To like I said, to be able to separate those two things, the two main things that we've kind of hit on. One is like learning from the past, and the other is like being discontent with the present and wanting to change the past. Mm-hmm. Because I think for the most part, most of us are in, or at least the three of us, even though we don't act out of it all the time, we are in a place where we understand we can't change the past. We understand God is moving in the present and that we're aiming for a future. Mm-hmm. So learn, but keep going forward. And not trying to just change what's in the past. So there's a delicate balance, because I feel like most people long for the past because they want to fix the mistake. And we've talked about this in other podcasts. We talked about it in Terminator. We talked about it in Edge of Tomorrow. You know, if you could go back, what would you change? Mm-hmm. Why would you change it? Mm-hmm. Would you really change it? What else would it change?
Right.
So I hope that we can, like, use this and say, I would like to understand the past better, but I don't want to live in regret.
Right. Well, and it's our only choice, unfortunately, unless...
That we know
there's some kind of time. I mean, who knows? And I think that possibility, you know, that something like out there exists, is that could be time traveling of some sort, is exciting. And I've always been excited by that fact, just because, you know, wouldn't it be cool? Mm-hmm. Simply just because of that. It doesn't really have to go much deeper than like when you. I'd love to go and hang out in the 50s, you know, with the cool cars and the...
And the racism.
Yeah,
Sexual menace.
See, I'm not going that deep, Biz. I'm not going that deep. You know, but I think that there's... Because we are the past. You know, we are... The past shapes us. And to go back and be able to view that, you know, it's like your mini selves... Throughout your lifetime, you're many different people. You know, you change and you get older and you get wiser. Hopefully,
maybe
you get fatter or skinnier or whatever it is. You know, you're different people throughout your lifetime is one way you can see things, and kind of like going back to the past is be able to kind of, you know, look at a sliver of yourself. You know, look at a piece of who you once were. Because I mean, you know, there's nothing new under the sun. Everything is everything's a remix, you know, that's which is a great series on the internet you should check out. But Everything's a Remix basically says, you know, we are, you know, art and even ourselves is just a different version of what we've learned and gained from the past. So to be able to just go back and like, you know, anything, you know, hear a speech from, you know, Abraham Lincoln or, mm-hmm. you know, just be there at the turn of the century, you know, hang out in some time that you're fascinated by. It's just a cool concept. And so, yeah, I mean that, you know, we move forward and that's our, you know, we don't have a choice, but that's our worldview, is to say that there is a better future, and that we can learn from the present and the past and move forward. You know, I think this movie and a lot of time travel movies give you that. It's sci-fi in general, really, because sci-fi is generally set in the future or some kind of fictional realm that we hope we can get to. Whether we can hope we can get to the past or we hope we can get to this idealistic future where there's, you know, spaceships and stuff like that.
Just spaceships.
Just spaceships. Be cool. Give me teleportation. I think I'd like to be beamed up somewhere. Anyway, you know, I think sci-fi gives us that chance to look at ourselves and really examine our past and relive it in a way, or live a version of our future in a way.
What's interesting is I feel like if we went to the past, a lot of Christians would want to go back and like meet Jesus, right?
Mm-hmm.
But then if you went back in the past, like, Jesus would know that you're from the future. He'd be like,
what are you doing, Mark? Here?
Yeah.
He wouldn't even have to ask. He'd just be like, what's up, Josh?
Nice.
Yeah.
Which I think is kind of funny, because when he programs, like, you know, he's like, or you could go back to the birth of Christ, and he's like, December 25th, 0000. And it's just so funny because, you know, being a pastor, my first thing that I go to is, that's not the right date.
Yeah, I was like, you're going to be sorely disappointed. That's exactly what I was thinking when we were just watching it. I was like, yeah, that's going to be a little bit of a disappointment, bud.
Yeah. Oh, man.
But what would a scientist know? science and religion don't mix. Oh,
zero, 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 zero.
All right, so let's... I don't even want to do come-on moments for this movie. It's been around for 30 years. You don't have to suffer through come-on moments if you're getting ready to celebrate 30 years of, like, cultural relevance. So, just...
But it's interesting, though, before you go into that, like, the Jesus thing, like... Are you, like, as a Christian, obligated to go do that? It's kind of like the kill Hitler scenario. Like, are you, like, are you officially, there's a new set of, like, morals come upon you because, like, you have this new power of time travel. Like, you know, do you have to go back and kill Hitler? I mean, okay. Do you have to go rid the world of evil?
So let's do this, then.
Rid existence.
Everyone out there who listens to the Back to the Future episode of this podcast, the discussion question for the comment section or Facebook or whatever is, do you have a moral obligation, or like, do you have some kind of I want to say compulsion, but that's not really what compel is in an action verb.
Are you compelled,
like, do you, is a requirement if you have time travel and you're a Christian to go, like, back and see Christ? Like, it's what you've got to do.
This is like, are you a band or are you a Christian band? Is your time travel machine a time travel machine, or is it a Christian
time travel? Is it a Christian time travel machine?
You can only go back to, like, the Ark. Hang out with Noah.
Yeah.
Or, you know, hang out with the disciples or Jesus.
Okay. Well, like, that's a ridiculous question. If there is one, and we're not going to answer this question on this episode, but like I said, I want other people to answer this and start this. If there's one biblical event that you could go back and witness, besides meeting Christ, what would it be? Because I think there is a ton of stuff, a ton of things in the Old Testament that would be amazing to witness. Because they're just like so many things that are just hit on for a second, and then like Bible keeps on going.
Yeah,
and I'm just like, what was that like? So, if you listen to this episode, that's your question for the comments. What would you go back? What biblical event would you go back in time to witness?
I like the morally obligated. Like,
I know. Compelled. You can answer that one too.
Are you compelled to, like, I mean, yeah, but, I mean, you go see Christ, but what is that going to, do good for people? Do you need to go kill Hitler? I mean, like, it's the kill Hitler scenario.
Well.
With every time travel, you know.
I think it's a, well.
That depends on your, there, just see now, you can tumble down a theological hole there and start talking about, is killing people. Okay, yeah.
All right, so, that's your homework. Hopefully that'll start a discussion. And we skip to closing down by, Josh, like, what is it about this movie? What is your favorite part of this movie?
What? You can't make me say a favorite part of this movie.
Well, you know how this works.
I know how it works.
Throw us your freaking bone here, Josh.
Can I say almost everything in the movie is my favorite?
You can, but that's not very interesting.
No, it's not very interesting, is it? Mm-hmm. At all.
It's not.
Okay. I'll say, like, my favorite parts after there was one thing on this umpteenth time rewatch that I finally figured out, that the homeless guy at the end is the mayor from 1955. So I finally figured that out. So there's another callback. So that I was just like, oh, no way, it is him. It's Red from 1955, the guy who was going for re-election.
Yeah, I never knew that.
Wow. So I thought that was really kind of fun. Gosh, what is my favorite part of this movie? I really enjoy a lot of the quotable moments in the movie, you know, obviously like 1.21 gigawatts and, you know, just Doc Brown's expressions, like, great Scott, Mm-hmm. And I love the my one of my favorite parts is when he grills Marty early on, you know, who's the president in 1985.
Oh, yeah.
And he's like, the actor, you know, Ronald Reagan, the actor. And you know, then he's just, you know,
so who's like, the vice president? Jerry Lewis?
Right. And I suppose Jane Wyman is the first lady. Yeah. And Benny Hill is the secretary of state. So it's just, I love that part. And then the other part that I really like is just because the comedic timing is so great and there's so many quick callbacks is when he's in the dining room with his grandpa and his grandma and his uncles and aunts in 1955. And there's all those quick callbacks, like Uncle Joey in the crib. And it's like, yeah, whenever yeah. we take him out, he always cries. So we just put him back in. And he's like, you know, they're just setting
better,
up.
Better get used to them bars, kid.
Right. And so, you know, there's all those things, you know, like, who the heck is John F. Kennedy? And all those great things. And I think it's just, it's the point in the movie where all of that quick dialogue that will start happening when Doc and Marty meet again in 1955, where it really gets great. Just the chemistry between the two of those, it's kind of captured a little bit there in that dining room scene at his mother's house in 1955.
Mm-hmm.
So that's definitely one of my favorite parts because it gets me back engaged to where the rest of the movie is going. And that's something that I really noticed in that one. So. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. All good stuff.
I mean, it's a whole movie, like you said.
Yeah,
the whole movie's great. You can't really choose something bad. If I pick my favorite thing, it's got to be Doc Brown. Mm-hmm. I mean, he's just one of my favorite characters ever. I think it's the way that Christopher Lloyd plays him, just so pitch perfect in so many ways. I mean, he never, you know, misses a beat. Like everything that he says and does is the way it needed to be done, and probably he even elevated what was on the page. But you know, even the script is great. I mean, you mm-hmm. can just tell that he. Really understood the part. He was the perfect choice for it. You know, and there's so many of those lines, you know, like where he's talking and he's like, man, this is heavy. And he's like, there's that word again. he's like, are things heavy in the future? Is there a problem with the Earth's gravitational pull? even the Ronald Reagan thing. I mean, there's so many things. And even in, you know, going back to the sequels, I mean, I actually prefer... Even though the future obviously is all wrong, I prefer the second movie, just because I was always more fascinated going into the future, at least when I was a kid, and so you know just he goes even further and stuff there and really just evolves the performance and I don't know he's just one of those iconic characters that you hook onto and he's funny but he's very very like earnest you know mm-hmm. he's very intentional in the things that he wants and his motivations and stuff. You're laughing at me. Why are you laughing?
No, I'm just laughing because I'm thinking of like things he said. Like when you say he's earnest, I'm thinking of like, he's like, do you know what this means? Yeah. I invented something that works.
Yeah.
You know, like he's so happy.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, that's great. You know, he shows up the first time with the past with the thing on his head. Mm-hmm. And he's like, let me try to guess. And he does the little guess.
Do you know what this means?
Yeah.
This thing doesn't work.
This thing doesn't work. You know, like, oh, it's so great. Yeah. So, I mean, you know, the character of Doc Brown is kind of the microcosm of the character of these movies. You know, it's very playful and fun and quirky and odd, but it's very earnest. You know, it's mm-hmm. very, there's a lot of heart to him. There's a lot of heart to this movie and the movies in general. And they're just playful and they make you just kind of relax and escape while you're enjoying, you know, a story and people and characters that you care about. And, you know, he's my favorite thing about the movies, though.
Mm.
I want to just watch his scenes over and over because he's just so great. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, no, so you... I thought you were going to pick out more scenes, mm-hmm. and I would be the one that did the character, but mm-hmm. Doc Brown, like, especially watching again today, just, every time I watch this movie, I keep forgetting how just funny Doc Brown is.
Yeah.
Like, engaging. Even the scenes that have, like, nothing to do with him. Because there's the scene where Marty's mom like tails him back to Doc's place in 1955. Yeah. And Doc Brown just like walking around the background, around, like at it, making weird faces. Just, and then there's the one where he's just in the scene when she's talking to Marty, asking him like if they'll go to the dance together. And Doc Brown's just leaning against the DeLorean, like really weirdly, yeah, just in the back of the shot, just being like, why are you here? And it's just hilarious. Yeah, it's great. All the things you said, like there's just so many funny lines there. I looking up some fun facts about the film, there's so many interesting facts about them writing like the Reagan lines and having to get that approved, mm-hmm, by Ronald Reagan, and then Ronald Reagan thinks it's insanely funny.
Yeah,
you know, things like that.
The story, I mean, is even better. I mean, like Ronald Reagan's watching it in a theater, mm-hmm, you know, private showing because he's the president, and that's back then when you were actually, you know, rolling the film, mm-hmm, through. And he laughed so hard he got them to stop the movie and roll it back so he could watch it again. Yeah, I mean, that's great. You know, yeah.
So yeah, so I hope that all of you out there who are listening to this have enjoyed kind of like our look back, our timely, hopefully, review of an older film that has cultural relevance still. 30 years. Mm-hmm. It's amazing when anything's been around this long. I mean, it's up there with Star Wars, Ghostbusters. You know, it's one of these films that it's just still good.
Oh yeah,
which is it's so hard to say that about so many about films, and it's actually kind of weird thinking that films that came out right after we were born are now that old, but that they still work. Because I mean, like, how many films do we see in any given year that you will probably want to watch again in 30 years?
Yeah,
and that's just a very, especially there's so many more films being made today than there were in 1985,
mm-hmm,
and you'd think with that volume, you'd get more,
mm-hmm,
at least, you know, just by sheer numbers. But you actually, I feel like you get less.
Mm-hmm.
So, because in 30 years, there's only, you know, maybe two. Well, this is and I've said this 100 times already this year on the podcast, but I think this is an exception. But like, go back to 2014. Like, how many of those films that came out in 2014 are you probably going to want to watch again in 30 years?
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's usually when I think about films that came out in 2014, I'm like, what came out last year?
Yeah.
I think, like I said, I think 2015 is going to be an exception, but for most years, I think it's really weird. So many films and so few that I can imagine still enjoying 30 years down the road.
So. And it's not even just you enjoy it because you have a connection to it because you watched it as a kid or something. Mm-hmm. This movie holds up.
Yeah, it's still good.
You see it now for the first time, you know, you're obviously young, but you see it now for the first time, and it's like, it's still exciting, and it still has that sense of its own time without being dated, you know, mm-hmm, like, you know, there's tons of movies I watched when I was a kid that I think of very fondly and think are great, and I watch them now, and it's like, man, it doesn't hold up. You know, that's just not there, but, you know, you have that endearment to it.
Mm-hmm.
This has beyond that, you know. This is its own thing. It stands alone, and it really holds up because it's made so well.
Well, again, all great points.
Yeah,
I feel like we just can't say enough good things about this movie.
You can't.
Which is again, while we're reviewing a movie that's 30 years old.
Also, because Fantastic Four was so awful, that
and because Fantastic Four was
we
so
punted.
But
yeah, this is so much more fun than talking about something like that.
Yeah.
So, as usual, I want to say as always, which is what I say, we're so glad that people would want to have a conversation about any movie, specifically this movie. So I want to thank Mark and Josh for being here, taking Absolutely. The time to have this conversation. Mm-hmm. And I want to make sure that you can follow the things that they're doing. So Josh, how can people connect with you, continue this conversation, quote Back to the Future with you on the internet?
Oh, please do that. Well, okay. Well, I pretty much do all of my writing, and everything that I do happens at Real World Theology. So perhaps you've heard of the site. So you can find me on Twitter at Hey, It's That Josh. You can also, like I said, read the writing that I do, reviews, the top fives, the Curing Netflix, Your Weekend, and the Reviewing the Classics, there you go. And the In Theaters posts. We do all of those at Real World Theology, so you can obviously keep looking there for that stuff. It's going on every single week. We've always got great stuff going on there. You can follow me on the Facebook for movie lovers, Letterboxd. Love talking to people on Letterboxd and love seeing people's reviews on Letterboxd. So I'm like a letterboxed apologist to pretty much everybody I know. And so it's like whether you have some opinions or tons of opinions on movies, it's a great place to go. And that's essentially where you can find me.
This episode of Real World Theology brought to you by Letterboxd.
That's right.
The Facebook for movie lovers.
And Real World Theology.
Yeah. All awesome. Right. You know me.
I do know you.
Yeah, you do.
Wait, who are you?
Yeah. Follow me on Twitter, Mark Wingdinger. And then I have a review series on Real World Theology, and occasionally we'll pop up in, you know, your Netflix the weekend here and there, maybe the one-off thing here and there. You never know, but that's primarily where you'll find me. I'm a screenwriter, so I write behind the scenes a lot, so I'm working on that every day, sort of.
And you can follow me at Fizzification, or you can follow the show at Real World Theo on Twitter. If you would like to know more about Real World Theology, then please visit our site where both of these fine gentlemen write, and that's realworldtheology.com. It's R-E-E-L, worldtheology.com. Connect with us on Facebook. Lots of you already do. We really appreciate you. Subscribe to the podcast on iTunes or Stitcher. I believe I just set up a feed burner for us, so if you just wanted the RSS feed, we can make that available to you. Connect to us. Let us know if or use our contact us if you want to contribute to the show. We love new contributors. We love people creating discussions. If you enjoy the show, if you enjoy the site, you know, review the show, leave us some feedback, tell your friends. Let's get more people involved in the conversation. And so, again, I just want to thank Mark and Josh for being here. Thanks, guys.
You're welcome.
Absolutely.
I want to thank you, the listeners, for taking time to make us a part of your week. And until next episode, remember that story is powerful and entertainment is not mindless.
And where we're going, we don't need roads. That's the power of a load. That's the power of a load.
Yep. Bye-bye. 't need to actually go find the power of love when we could all just like sing it.
Pretty much.
We can just do it in like some kind of
free. Don't need money. Don't need things. Don't need no credit card to ride this train. Strong in the sun. It's cruel sometimes, but it might just save your life. That's the power of love. Dun, 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 dun.